Chapter 4. Ofar was uncomfortable in his uniform. He was uncomfortable in most uniforms and most clothes, and had come to accept that his physical dimensions meant that he probably always would be. He had been gangly since birth, possessed of limbs that constantly seemed to be trying to make their own way in the world. Now he was old, too. He was older than he'd ever expected to be. His life extended by the treatments available in this terrifying, exciting new world of possibility. He didn't even know exactly how old he was, since the earliest years in the Banda settlements had been chaotic and violent. But he knew that, had he not left when he did, he would not still be irritably reflecting on ill-fitting clothes, or on anything at all. Occasionally he would ponder this strange turn of events when his duties allowed him. He could still experience a powerful sense of shock at the pace at which everything had changed. Sometimes, but not often, he would miss the old world with its suffocating heat and variety, its sense of danger and its essential fragility. The new reality was an austere place, already obsessed with laws and regulations. More scholars had come to Himalaya, they reckoned, than warriors. Already the palace was struggling to feed itself, importing much of what it consumed from lowlands far away. That trend, Ofar thought, could only continue. It was, after all, a ludicrous place to build a city. Still, this was where Uwama had chosen to come, and where Uwama went, so did he. That was the one constant, something to cling on to, even as the planet around was reshaped and rebuilt into new and dizzying forms. This uniform was particularly scratchy. It had taken a while to put together, he remembered, and they had struggled to get the details right. Most officials in the rapidly growing bureaucracy, which they were already beginning to call, with absurd pomposity, the Adeptus Terror, seemed to source their robes from bafflingly obscure places, buried under levels of cipher-protected security and knowledge keys. That was not altogether surprising, since the positions themselves were now prized targets, offering a route out of poverty for the gifted and the well-connected. A life of relative drudgery in an archive or a cogitator depot was far more attractive than the windswept alternatives, and so competition was fierce and privileges jealously guarded. Uwama was a powerful woman now, though, and so the right palms were greased and the right passes obtained. Ofar passed for a senior administratum perfectus pretty well. He even had a fake augmetic eyepiece, which gave him a nasty rash, but rounded out the effect to satisfaction. It was astonishing, he always found, the degree to which such flimsy things gave him passage to all sorts of places. Armina had kitted him out with a brace of stolen ident pulses and lockwords, but he rarely needed to use them. Just the sight of his uniform, wine-red robes and hood, ivory chasuble, the eagle's head and lightning sigils stitched in gold thread above the right breast, was enough for most purposes. The people were already learning deference, Ofar noted. They were forgetting the anarchy and reverting to the long-run servile type. Commands rarely needed to be enforced here. They were taken on enthusiastically, drunk in, by a populace who still remembered the alternatives. It was understandable, though hard to admire. He remembered the brine smell of the gasping salt pans and the burning engine oil over the hot plains, and missed the old place more than ever. Now everything was cold. He shivered as he walked, not hurrying, not tarrying, adopting the scholar shuffle that the rest did. He passed through crowds of them, all doing the same, carrying bundles of paper or heaps of message tubes. Every chamber smelled new, and most were still filmed with the dust of construction. Galleries had been delved far into the rock heart of the peaks, now heated by great geothermal shafts, but it never seemed enough to keep the air from chilling, and in any case, Ofar's circuit took him high up, out onto the walls, where the gales were always biting. The recent round of observations had taken him 3 days. He'd ensured that his route altered every time, always keeping out of eyeline with the inner walls unless he was in position to take a reading. The equipment he'd been given was good. He could record several hundred Picts on a single circuit, all blink-controlled, and then double-cipher-interred within the augmetic eyepiece. 2 nights ago, he'd spent a long time out on the western redoubt, huddled down against a semi-built inner parapet with a perfect vantage on the Sanctum Imperialis and the heavy works in the intervening valleys. His augmetic had whirred, his cogitated plan overlays had recalculated. It had been a precious moment, one in which he picked up a good slug of data to be analysed later. He saw them, up on the ramparts, heading away one by one. Golden warriors, plumed with crimson, just tiny dots in the distance and part hazed by the dust in the air. They were already the symbols of the place, its guardians, the custodians, not just of the palace, but of the Imperium itself. No one knew how many there were, not even Awama. That was for him to find out, of course, though the results were already beginning to surprise him. That had been 2 nights ago. Now he was on the trail of different quarry, one of considerably less elevated pedigree, but no less importance, at least to the matter at hand. Night was falling, though the murmur and clank of construction never ceased. As the light died in the west, the lumens flickered on, spilling weak orange light across the gritty thoroughfares. Ophar descended through the outer tangle of the Masonic quarters, where the hab blocks were rammed up tight and the shadows in the narrow streets lay heavy. It was a bustling, claustrophobic space, every inch of it crushed with the steady movement of people. Neon signs had been slung overhead, some proclaiming gaudy imperial propaganda. A new age dawns. The Emperor delivers it. Report all suspicious activity to your local Arbites Tower. Others with commercials from the big trading guilds. Out of the mountain wind, the smells became more varied. Medical supplies with their chemical tang, caged animals smuggled in under the noses of the customs watchers, the earthy stinks of close-packed humanity. Music blared from the cheap voxcasters, tinny electro-synth ballads, stirring military anthems sung by regimental choirs, all blending into a cacophony that swilled and swirled through the narrow passages and made the hubbub of different dialects all the more unintelligible. He was not the only robed official making his way through the jostling masses, and few gave him a second glance. Everything had an air of impermanence, of semi-completion, as if foundations were still being settled into place and no one quite knew just what would be piled on top of them yet. He stepped aside to allow the passage of a big lurching personnel carrier, then slipped down a narrow side street. In the distance, he could just make out the towering watch piers of the checkpoint gate, several stories higher than the surrounding buildings. That was where most of the incoming traffic from the southern approach highways came in, and he knew there were queues of transport stretching far out into the landscape beyond, waiting for their turn for scrutiny. Several flyers hung like hawks in the evening gloaming, their autoguns trained to respond to the first sign of disturbance. This was a weak point, a point of danger, a point of opportunity. All gates were. Away from the main thoroughfare, things got darker and quieter. He passed open doorways with occupants backlit by grimy lumens, families crammed into one-room apartments, children squalling, arguments floating out into the night air. He found the stairwell and dropped down a tight spiral of metal steps. The smell of some oily cooking wafted up from grills in the brick walls on either side, and soon he was before a blast plate door with a slit opening. He bent down and rapped on it, 3 knocks, then 2 more. A panel flashed up with a red sigil stream, a meaningless collection of runes, unless you knew what to look for. Ophar inserted the lockword into the slot and waited for the clunk. He pressed his face up against a glassy panel by the door hinges and felt the hot prickle of a dermal scan. Then the lock snapped and the door swung inwards. After that, there were more stairs, going down again, getting hotter and darker. He was frisked by a burly guard who looked half-mutant, his pale pink skin swelling behind ill-fitting armour plates. Then he was ushered into the room beyond, and the door slammed closed behind. "Hello, Halleck," said a man sitting behind a metal desk. "If that's really your name." Ofar grabbed a chair, hiking his robes as he sat down.
"Hello, foreign check," he said. "If that's really yours."
The man was skinny, dressed in synth leather fatigues and with purple glass spectacles perched on a long nose. His fingers drummed and twitched on the desktop. Behind him stood cabinets with neatly labelled drawers. An olive thick pile carpet made the floor feel sticky, and an air cycler rattled away in the background. "Got it?" Voronchek asked. Ofar pulled up his sleeve and flicked open the lead-lined panel inserted into his inner forearm. The original bone had been mangled in the escape from Banda all those years ago, and its replacement had proved far more useful. A credit bead popped out, and he tossed it over to Voronchek. The man took it, pulled a verifier from one of the desk's compartments, and ran the checks. The machine screen blinked out an allocation total. Voronchek smiled. "Fine," he said. "That'll do. Tell me, though, I know they pay you people well, but not this well. So which departamento are you assigned to again?"
"Departamento Misterioso. Look it up. It's well-resourced."
Voronchek laughed.
"Fair enough."
He reached for another compartment and produced a data slate. It was of an old design, one of the marks produced back when a bomb could fall at any time, and ruggedness was prized over portability. The protective sleeve looked as though it had rusted, and its connector plugs were mottled with patina.
"This has everything for the past 2 months, plus some annexes that we had from an earlier sweep. Consider it a free gift, mostly because you didn't haggle. I don't like haggling. We should be past all that now, don't you think?"
Ofar took the slate, extended a reader probe, and slid it into the plug. He felt a mild tingle as the input flood bundled into his augmetic reader. The data was there, just as it should be, complete with verifier seals and authentication warrants. These were hard to forge, even for those with the resources to try.
"More than I thought," murmured Ofar, watching the figures slide across his visual field. "More than I thought, too," said Voronchek. "If you hadn't ever come down here and started to raise those most interesting questions, we'd never have minded all, which makes me wonder who you are again. See, I just can't help myself." "These primary seals, what's their origin?" Ofar asked, ignoring him. "I don't know. Not ones I've seen before, but they supersede the customs clearance vectors, so someone powerful. You want my guess? These were issued in the Senatorum right at the top, or near the top. Look carefully. None of this stock's been skimmed. Even my stuff gets skimmed, and we have the security to make people scared of us. But these detachments, they're all intact, squeaky clean. Never seen that before." "And none were intercepted?" "They went right on through. Like I said, if you hadn't showed up..."
"But I didn't, Voronchek. I was never here. We never had this conversation."
Voronchek laughed.
"Oh, really? Well, that's more difficult. I have a lot of people who might be interested in this. You pay well, but..."
"We pay very well."
Ofar cut off the feed and slotted the security clasp over the slate's plugs.
"You might like to reflect on that. You might like to reflect on how serious we must be to be able to pay you so well, so quickly, without any prior clearance. You might like to further reflect that your operations over the prescribed zones are well known to us, and that your name is not Voronchek, but Erlak, and that your blood family, whom I can itemize in detail if you really wish me to, currently reside in Sector 45E of the settled inner urban zone without anything like the appropriate paperwork. And finally, you might like to reflect that knowing all this and having as much resource as we clearly have, it might be best to count your blessings, take the payment you have been given, and never mention this to anyone else for as long as your gilded existence here continues to be tolerated.
Voronchek hesitated. A smile flickered across his thin lips, then died, as if he were trying to work out how seriously to take that. Ofar never let his eyes drop, but waited patiently.
"See, if you put it like that, I'll be going now. Ensure that any copies of this are destroyed. Do not have me followed, and do not speak of this to anyone. I think we understand one another."
Voronchek nodded, then leaned forwards, elbows on the table, as if he wanted to whisper something.
"Just tell me one thing," he said quietly. "I saw what was in the manifests. I can't unsee them. What in hell are they coming in for? How much could they, anybody, possibly need?"
Ofar stood up, stowing the slate within his robes.
"I don't know," he said, making ready to leave. "That's the problem."
Kandawire was small, even by the standards of the baseline species. She was in relatively poor physical condition, a result of a fondness for cocoa-based confections and a disdain for exercise. Her fat-muscle ratio was suboptimal, her blood pressure far too high. The man before her, if he could even be called a man, was comfortably twice her height. The outline of his body, visible under the linen of his robes, looked so unyielding it might just as well have been rockcrete. Their chairs were almost comically out of proportion, hers modest, his carved like Egyptian pharaohs. The disparity was so enormous that, after a while, it ceased to be noticeable. Of all of it, though, his face was the most unsettling thing. She had never witnessed him truly up close before, and certain expectations became hard to sustain. He did not have the kind of face she expected. It was slim, with youthful lines. His head was shaved, exposing a small augmetic bead high up on the right side. Like everything else about him, it was understated, exquisitely formed. He waited for her to speak again, holding himself perfectly still. It was hard to detect whether his chest was even moving enough to account for the drawing in of oxygen. Surely he had to breathe. Surely they couldn't gene-craft that out of them.
"I have a recording device," she said. "I would like to use it."
"Understood. Please place it where I can see it."
Kandawire retrieved it, a smooth disc a centimetre across, and placed it on the arm of the chair.
"This is about process," she said.
"Yes, that is what your staff told mine."
"We live in perilous times. We cannot go back to the way things were."
"Agreed on both counts."
"As the representative of civilian government, the counterweight to the military orders, it is imperative that things are not hidden, that all is made plain between us."
"Madam High Lord," said Valdor, "all of this has already been determined. We are short of time. As I say, what do you wish to know?"
Kandawire found herself strangely reluctant to begin, now that the moment had come. It was as if, having come so far, reaching the end was something to be swerved away from. She gestured to the disc, and it pulsed into a soft standby light.
"I would like to begin with Morland Sen," she said.
"Morland Sen," Valdor replied. "That is not a name I recall with any fondness."